WFF with Green Firm. Naturally good food packed with protein.
Thank you to the fantastic Jenny Green. Back with you tomorrow at 3 o'clock, kickstarting the weekend. It's Thursday, the 9th of July, and this is Game On.
Taylor digging in, but Pessoa will not give this up. It's been an incredible, resilient display from Pessoa. Taylor trying to match her, but is she?
Jeff Shepherd on the big bucks in the big league for this guy.
Turns what might have been a 15-yard sack into a 27-yard touchdown.
Stop it. Stop it. You can't do this. Patrick Mahomes, just stop it. We haven't seen this. I mean, we've seen Brett Favre. We've seen Aaron Rodgers. We've seen John Elway. I just don't remember anybody doing what this young man has done so far in the league.
We'll also be talking soccer scouting from home with Lisa Fallon. We'll also have Brent Pope and Johnny Holland joining Dunica to talk Super Rugby.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM, and we would really love to hear from you. Damien, it's so busy with sport at the moment, it's rare we actually get to look back a bit, but it would be wrong to move on from last night and not mention John Egan grabbing the late winner, 93 minutes.
Can I ask you a question? As a former sportsman, and you know fellas wait years for their first try, and then they score a hat-trick within about 3 weeks, and you'd wonder what sort of pressure must have been taken off him last weekend to have finally got his first Premier League goal, and what is he now, 2 from 2, and Chris Wilder wants him to get 10 over the course of the season, so he's 4 games left to get 8 goals.
Yeah, thankfully for me that was never a problem, but I think you're right, it's just having the weight off his shoulders to get the first one. And his goal last night was brilliant, wasn't it?
But isn't a good old school central defender, you know, just none of this fancy stuff. Just throw yourself at the ball and hope you make contact.
Yeah, look, my football knowledge isn't great, but there's loads to like about Sheffield United, isn't there?
We talked about this, was it with Ruby on Monday? Or certainly at some point, that you look at the work that Klopp has done at Liverpool, and they've won a first Premier League a first league title in 30 years. You look at the job that Chris Wilder has done with Sheffield United. He is the manager of the year. He has to be.
Yeah. Marie would fight that out with you. She wouldn't hear of anything else for Klopp.
I know, but I'm a Liverpool fan, and I'd give it to Chris Wilder ahead of giving it to Klopp. But I loved at the start of the year the romance about, I still get the bus across Sheffield, and I used to get the bus to the stadium with my dad, and I was thinking, this is all going to end in tears in about 3 weeks' time, when all the newspapers will have, you know, send this man a bus ticket because he's on the way out of Bramall Lane. But it's gone brilliantly for them.
And it's brilliant for Ireland, isn't it? To have people, like we're chatting as well tonight, Everton take on Southampton. You could say it's a dead rubber, 11 versus 12, but there's loads of Irish interest.
Yeah, Seamus Coleman starts for Everton, captains Everton, obviously. There's 4 Irish players on the bench for Southampton. Will Ferry, Shane Long, Michael Obafemi and Will Smallbone. So I think Southampton set a record last weekend that they were the first team since Stoke donkeys years ago to have 4 Irish players on the bench. So I suppose we don't want them on the bench, we want them on the pitch, don't we?
Yeah, but, absolutely.
But at least it's... And you know what? It was interesting. I was reading some of the newspaper. Like, obviously, we'd the interview with Stephen Kenny with Tony O'Donoghue on the programme last night, but was reading some of the newspaper coverage with him today, and he was making the point about, if you look at the age profile within the squad, and you know, you've Aaron Connolly coming through at Brighton, but aside from that, we don't have this massive depth of young players who've progressed in the last couple of years. So it'd be great to see your Ferries, your Smallbones, people like that, you know, getting proper Premier League game time, and you know, perhaps hopefully giving them a few headaches.
Yeah, and you're right. I read the same thing. It's like there's a generational gap. There's 28 down to 19. It's a massive gap between players, and James McLean togs out tonight. He's playing with Stoke versus Leeds, which gets underway.
It's underway, and it's not going well. If you're a Leeds fan, you'll be delighted. Leeds are 2-0 up. It's the 48th minute of the game, but poor old James McLean won't be smiling tonight when himself and Nathan Collins both starting tonight, but they're 2-0 down.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Like, which club would you have a bit of a graw for if it was to force you?
Yeah, no, I'm a Liverpool fan, but I kind of inherited the team in my house. So all my brothers were Liverpool supporters, so I didn't even get a say in it. And I remember One FA Cup final, I had a bit of a fallout with them that, you know, I never decided to pick Liverpool. I'm going to support Wimbledon. And Wimbledon went on to win the FA Cup final 1-0 and I bawled my eyes out. I was there, I don't want to support Wimbledon.
We have, I was going to say, because any time you talk about Leeds, the amount of Leeds fans that still exist in the country.
Tommy Bo.
Well, there you go.
The great Tommy Bo, and he will be glued to it and he'll be delighted. But you're right, I think... you know, you look at all the great Irish players that played over there in the past, and there is a brilliant tie, a bit like Aston Villa as well.
Yeah,
isn't
big
it?
Time. Yeah, we have a problem in our house. I won't go into this in great depth, but my kids and you had the misfortune of have both my kids land on you in O'Hare Airport
nice. Years ago.
Yeah,
their mother.
My daughter screaming and roaring. There's Dunnock O'Callaghan. And I was like, how do you know who Dunnock O'Callaghan is? He does. Dunnock is too talented. So my eldest, my daughter, is a mad Liverpool fan and sat down last night to watch the game. My son was watching Chelsea against Newcastle a couple of months back and decided, I don't like red, I like blue. And I didn't mention it for months. Tried to put a pair of Liverpool shorts on him when the good weather, we had it about 2 weeks ago. And I don't like Liverpool, I like Chelsea. And I now have a 4.5-year-old Chelsea obsessive in the house, so... His sister is going to inherit whatever meagre amount of money I leave when my time comes.
No, you can bribe him with gear. I think that's the best way to do it. You need to chat to Marie. She's great at sourcing and making sure. I've never seen kids with more sporting jerseys than her boys, so you need to get chatting to her.
Yeah, the problem is his mother now is intent on igniting the Chelsea flame just to wind myself and my dad and my sister or the lot of us up. So anyway, come here.
There's no winners in that.
Will we press on and get stuck into one of the big stories of the
Absolutely.
Day? Big news, I think confirmed, certainly news that was expected over the last couple of days. It's been confirmed today that Katie Taylor will defend her WBC, WBA, IBF, WBO and Ring Magazine lightweight world titles in a rematch against Delphine Persoon on the 22nd of August. She became the undisputed champion with, let's be very honest, a controversial points decision over the Belgian at Madison Square Garden last year. Taylor had been set to fight Amanda Serrano, but we might talk about this in a second, but depending on who you listen to, different reasons were put forward for that not happening. Joining us to chat about this and much more is Gavin Casey from the 42.ie. Gavin, this is one of these bouts. This rematch was inevitable. It was going to happen at some stage, but it's a massive fight for Katie Taylor in light of the analysis of the last meeting.
It certainly is. I think it's a massive fight for Katie in terms of her legacy in professional boxing. And I think it's a massive fight as well for women's professional boxing, which, while it's been on an upward trajectory over the last 3 years, the progress in that has probably gone hand in hand, really, with Taylor's rise through the ranks. I would say that her last fight with Persoon last June at Madison Square Garden was probably the only female fight that I've seen that really moved the needle and kind of transcended that code, became a kind of a mainstream story. It was certainly a fight that captivated a mainstream or probably predominantly male boxing audience in the arena. I was there myself, and it's one of the best sporting atmospheres I've ever experienced. And I think a lot of the people who would have been present for it were probably just queuing up or getting into their seats in anticipation of Anthony Joshua's fight, which was to follow. But they were treated to an absolute spectacle. On this occasion, it'll take place in Eddie Hearn's garden, quite literally. He's got a sort of a setup outside of his mansion in Brentwood in Essex. So there'll be no fans present, but it still should prove to be, I think, a fascinating encounter, a spectacular encounter. There is bad blood between both fighters. And as you say, for Taylor, it's a massive fight. I think what makes this fight such a tantalising prospect is the jeopardy involved in it. From a legacy standpoint, if Taylor was to lose this one, and in the eyes of plenty of people, she lost the last one, then she has essentially got two defeats on her record, even though I personally don't think she lost the first fight. I scored it a draw. But in the eyes of the masses, in the eyes of the kind of wider boxing community, she'd be deemed to be merely a hype job if she loses this rematch. So there's a huge amount on the line. And on the flip side of it, in a kind of a more positive twist, if she wins this fight, we know that Delphine Persoon is a really legitimate world-class fighter. And if Katie was to beat her more concretely, more conclusively this time around, it absolutely elevates her standing within the world of boxing and probably within the annals of female professional boxing as well.
Gavin, we know how much of a competitor she is, and she'd actually probably like that, to make it undisputed, to make sure that, you know, people aren't going around calling it a draw or a narrow win. She'd want to put it right herself.
Absolutely. I think she's probably brave-faced it since that very night. I remember in the press conference afterwards, you know, I wouldn't have said she was in the greatest of humours for somebody who had just won the undisputed title and had become only the third ever woman to do so. I'd say privately she was seething at her performance that night. She probably got dragged into the type of encounter, kind of a rough and tumble back and forth that betrayed her pure boxing ability and played into Delphine Persoon's hands. Persoon was lighter on the night by a fair few pounds, actually, but she is the physically stronger of the two women. And on occasion, throughout those 10 rounds, she did bully Taylor. And that wouldn't have sat well with Taylor at the time. Like, for a woman who's kind of exceedingly shy outside of the ring, she does purvey a lot of bravado within it. She likes to be the woman in there and in the boss of proceedings, in charge of the fight. And so I think as a result of her being pushed backwards a little bit and just roughhoused a little bit, she just got dragged into the type of fight that didn't suit her. I think she will absolutely want to set the record straight. She said herself upon the announcement today that she intends to leave no doubts this time around. And look, that's the jeopardy of the fight that we're talking about. I think it's an interesting kind of, I don't know, like, their change, I guess, in the environment this time around is the fact that there will be no fans present. We're talking about literally a garden setting with only a handful of fight officials, referees, judges, promotional staff, etc., on hand to witness this, as well as obviously TV cameras. And you'd wonder how much that could impact her performance. For example, I've seen Taylor on plenty of occasions when the crowd gets going and the hairs start to stand up in the back of people's necks. She really gets into that. She sort of feeds off it and goes hell for leather, probably to the detriment of her defense. And she likes to take a few shots to give a few more, if you know what I mean. This time around, with no crowd, does she box a little bit more carefully, more tactically? And does she perhaps not get drawn into that type of encounter that we saw last June? So it may work in her favour that there aren't 15 or so thousand people on hand to watch it this time around.
Let's hear what she's had to say herself. She's been chatting today to Sky Sports.
The Persoon rematch is very, very important to them as well. Obviously, a lot of people had her win the fight, so I definitely need to put that to bed. And I think the next time I do fight, I'll definitely be... I'll just put on a better performance. It was a particularly bad performance, I think, during that night. But thankfully, I dug deep and was able to get the win in a very, very close fight. And you're right, it could have definitely went either way. I'm so grateful that it did go my way on that night. So I'm looking forward to that rematch, and I'm looking forward to putting on a dominating performance.
Gavin, the interesting thing from that clip is the best of motivation comes from within, and she's not hiding away from the fact that there is maybe a little small asterisk alongside the last result.
Absolutely. I think it's a fascinating kind of dynamic to this one in that, as you say, there is kind of an asterisk next to it. She's probably the most disputed, undisputed champion in boxing that we've seen in the last few years. And she has this sort of weird, unusual opportunity to avenge a victory, whereas Delphine Persoon is obviously seeking revenge for defeat. Katie Taylor is looking for a victory to prove that she actually won the first time, or at least prove that she is the better fighter. Like, both of the fighters are going into this one with massive points to prove. Both of them actually feel probably a little bit wronged from the fallout of the last one. At least Persoon felt as though the scores on that occasion, 96-94, 96-94 and 95-95, were unjust. It's absolutely the slenderest of margins you can possibly get in a boxing match in order to achieve a victory from Taylor's point of view. And Taylor will feel as though the blowback that she received and the tweets and the analysis and the punditry on Sky Sports and DAZN in the States were probably a little bit harsh on her. As she says, it was a close fight. And as I said at the beginning of the chat, when I was in the arena in New York, I scored it a draw. When I watched it back in the house I was staying in New York afterwards, I scored it a draw as well, albeit I switched a couple of rounds. I think a lot of the outcry after that fight was actually unjust. I think a lot of people were complaining about a fight that maybe they hadn't seen necessarily, and they were kind of like jumping on a bandwagon. But also, I think even people who did watch the fight would have been struck by the final round, in which Taylor was really out in her feet. Possibly if you had an extra two rounds, if it was a 12-round fight, like a male fight, Persoon could conceivably have stopped her. We'll never know, but that might have been the sort of I guess the lasting image, or the lasting perception of it, was that Taylor was getting dominated. Whereas if you were actually to score it round by round, which is what you're supposed to do in boxing. Taylor, I think, won enough rounds at least not to lose the fight, albeit I didn't personally have her winning it myself.
Gavin, Damien's been getting me up to speed on all this. I was surprised to hear that Amanda Serrano has taken up a reality TV show instead of this fight. It's quite unusual, isn't it?
It is unusual, although I think people, particularly Irish boxing fans who are familiar with Serrano and her shtick at this point, might not find it so surprising. Now, unfortunately for her, if it appears though that reality TV show won't actually happen either. So what happened was, she originally signed, in fairness, to fight Katie Taylor back in the spring. It would have been late February, early March. The fight was scheduled for the 2nd of May at Manchester Arena, where Taylor had just beaten Christina Leonardo 2 last November amid this kind of electrifying atmosphere again. So it was a really salivating prospect that this seven-weight world champion from Puerto Rico, who has spoken ill of Taylor enough times to really kind of, cultivate a ferocious enough rivalry between them, and then the Irish icon, two-weight world champion. It was all on the line. It was a fight 2-3 years in the making, really. Serrano has done her best over the last few years to distance herself from the fight. She's migrated to MMA. She's complained about money. Pretty much every excuse in the book she could possibly find, she's taken in order to avoid a fight with Katie Taylor. And that's not to suggest necessarily that she fears Taylor or that she's fully ducking her. It's more so that she doesn't like to have terms dictated to her. She doesn't appreciate being the B-side in an equation, whereas Taylor is the promoter's fighter, the big name, the first name on every poster and so on. Serrano feels as though after a professional boxing career consisting of more than a decade, that she's paid her dues and that she probably is being treated somewhat unfairly, or at least isn't getting a fair enough crack of the whip and so on. So when that fight that was scheduled for the 2nd of May was inevitably postponed with the onset of COVID-19, it was rescheduled twice more, but Serrano basically, after the second rescheduled date was cancelled again, she took it upon herself to enter this reality TV show. It's kind of a Survivor-style show on a Spanish-language channel in America, the prize fund for which was $200,000. But Eddie Hearn took umbrage with that because he claimed that via the contract Serrano had signed, there was a force majeure which dictated that he was within his rights to reschedule the fight at a date of his choosing, and therefore, in his mind, she was in breach of contract. He got onto the network that were going to be broadcasting this Survivor-style reality TV show, informed them of Serrano's contractual situation. She was subsequently pulled from the show, and as a result of all of that fallout and a number of legal threats and indeed legal letters that arrived into both Serrano and her promoter, Lou DiBella, she basically said she wasn't going to fight Katie Taylor. She didn't want to travel over to, again, the promoter's literal backyard, albeit I'm not sure how that would have worked necessarily in Taylor's favour, because, again, there are no fans there to sway anybody in a particular direction. But the long and short of it is that Serrano didn't wish to fight on this occasion, much the same as she hasn't wished to fight on numerous previous occasions. And Eddie Hearn reached out to Persoon's team as a kind of a contingency plan. And what we have now, in fairness, is a fight that's as big as the Serrano fight, if not bigger, actually, in that Persoon, through her original fight with Taylor, is kind of a big name now in boxing.
Okay, we'll see how it all plays out. They'll do battle. It's been billed as the Matchroom Fight Camp in Brentwood, but in reality, it's Eddie Hearn's back garden. But sure, whatever it is, needs to be, it needs to be. Gavin, thanks so much for being with us. Gavin Casey from the42.ie. 51552 for your text. That game on 2FM will get us on Twitter. Scoreless still in the 2 6 o'clock kickoffs in the Premier League. Southampton did have the ball in the Everton net, but ruled out as a result of offside. We're going to the States to chat to Shep next.
Game on, Iron America.
Okay, welcome back to Game On. Tom Cruise shouted, "Show me the money," when playing the part of Cuba Gooding Jr.'s agent in the Hollywood blockbuster Jerry Maguire. But Patrick Mahomes' agent could be shouting, "What are we going to do with all this money?" when this year's Super Bowl MVP signed a 10-year extension with the Kansas City Chiefs to become the first $500 million player in sports history. That's right, $500 million. We're delighted to be joined by our stateside teammate, Jeff Shepherd. Shep, we know what Patrick Mahomes is going to be doing till 2031, playing football and making money angels. No, sorry, Shep.
Yeah, and swimming in his money vault like Scrooge McDuck.
It's an incredible deal, isn't it?
You know, it really is. It's an incredible deal on a lot of different fronts. I mean, I think first and foremost, look, give the Chiefs credit. They could have waited and figured out what the market was. Well, look, they went out and they locked him up. That's how much faith they have in him. And they went out and set the market. And so now, you know, you'll have to basically see who's the next batch of quarterbacks that could even remotely come close to making that much money. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, once this old guard of Brees and Brady and Rodgers retire, I don't exactly know where that next quarterback is that's going to even come remotely close to this. But they went out and they put the line in the sand and said, this is our guy. We believe in him. We want to keep him here. We want him to be a Chief for life is pretty much what they just came out and said that they were going to do. And so, as you said, he becomes the first $500 million player in sports. He's the highest paid player in American sports. It's the first time an NFL player has ever been the highest paid player in American sports. Now, guys, look, the other side of this coin is once you start getting into the salary cap, and look, I mean, the salary and the contract is going to have all of these, you know, bonuses and different things. And I think that's where he's going to wind up making a lot of this money. But, you know, when you've got a young I'm going to put this word in quotes, the easiest way to win a Super Bowl in the NFL is when you've got a young quarterback and you're paying him in his first couple of years in his contract when they're not making a lot of money, when they're only making $800,000 a year as opposed to making 35 like Dak Prescott or something like that, you know? And you can then go spend it on linebackers and safeties and wide receivers and different things like that, all of the pieces of the puzzle that go. When you tie up a lot of money with a quarterback in one position like this, it makes it a lot more difficult, you know, to attract free agents and do different things like that. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. You know, obviously it's a home run for Mahomes. Pardon the pun, whose dad played Major League Baseball when he was a kid. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over a decade in Kansas City. And the last thing I want to say is this isn't New York or Los Angeles or, you know, the Dolphins or somebody like that, or the Cowboys that are making the splash. This is, you know, middle America, Kansas City, who went out and paid $500 million for a quarterback. I think that's a really interesting angle to the story.
And Shep, you can talk until the cows come home about is he worth it, is he worth this, how much is that fellow worth. Ultimately, a franchise thinks this is the best investment for us and he's the guy who's going to benefit. But how has it been greeted? Because it just seems so grotesque to us in terms of the figures involved.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, it's a $500 million. I mean, it's $500 million, okay? So, I mean, yes, it is a tremendous amount of money. And is he worth it? Look, that's only answered by, do people show up and pay the money to buy tickets to go watch this guy and his teams play football? If they do, then he's absolutely worth it, because you know that the Chiefs are going to make more money than that. I mean, that's how business works. And so, I mean, you just have to look at the, you know, the basic economics of it is he'll be worth it. You know, once it's you know, once you get through the end of the contract and if they win and, you know, all of that. I mean, it's merchandise. It's all of the different things that the team makes its money back on, and television rights and all that. I mean, he is going to be the primetime player in the NFL for, I mean, knock on wood, he stays healthy for the next decade, you know? And so you're talking Sunday night, Monday night, Thursday night football, when all eyes in America, and as the game expands in popularity across, you know, Ireland and Europe and the other parts of the world, all eyes will be on this guy. And so that's where that, you know, that revenue comes back into the Kansas City Chiefs.
Chip, what makes him such a special talent? You know, why have Kansas City decided they're going to try to make a dynasty around this player?
So it's a couple of different things, Donners. I mentioned earlier, you know, his dad played professional baseball in the 90s. And it's just – so, you know, he grows up with a mentality of, you know, kind of seeing what it takes to be the best at a position or to make it to the professional leagues, just kind of ingrained in you kind of from the beginning. He has got a rocket of an arm, and he can throw the ball, and he can run and move. I mean, he's this combination of, you know, some of these things that all the, you know, the good mobile quarterbacks have done over the years, plus all the good throwing quarterbacks have done over the years. He's kind of got it all, and he's very smart. You know, he's really, really intelligent on the field. He doesn't make a lot of mistakes. He doesn't really beat himself. But again, he's got a great arm. They've got a really good offense. And so I think that's what they're betting on. I mean, they're quite honestly, they're betting on him getting better. Because, again, he's only been in the league, what, 3 or 4 years, I think, at this point. So they're betting on his this next decade, you know, when he's going to know what every defense is throwing at him and, you know, how to audible to different routes and how to get out of situations. They're expecting him to be even better than he was this year when he won the Super Bowl and was the MVP.
Just in terms then, away from that, again, we're in a situation where race and equality and so many issues around American society are dominating the sporting headlines again this week. The Washington Redskins, it's now inevitable, one would think, that that franchise name is going to have to change. And that probably comes in tandem with, in the MLS, possibly the most poignant of the Black Lives Matters, I don't know if protests is still the right word to use, but certainly gestures of solidarity.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, this is obviously a topic that has not quieted down or gone away, and I don't anticipate it happening anytime soon, good or bad, because the opposite side of the coin is what DeSean Jackson said this week, which is some of the dumbest things I've ever heard in my life. But, you know, so with regards to the Redskins, I would be stunned if the Redskins are the Redskins if we play football this year. I honestly think that the league and the team are going to get the name changed before football occurs this year. I mean, I think that that is how quickly that this is going to happen. And when the thing that I'm really struggling with, and I obviously think it's a good thing that it happens, but why all of a sudden? I mean, Dan Snyder has been pretty adamant about, you know, keeping it the name as the Redskins because of all this alleged work that the team did and this outreach that they had done with the Native American community. And all of a sudden now they need to change it. George Floyd wasn't a Native American. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand why all of a sudden it was just, we need to make this change. They should have made it years ago. But now they're going to make it, and that's good. And then, I mean, look, guys, was it last week they made the announcement that they were going to begin the process? And about 3 hours later, the Cleveland Indians, the baseball team, they came out and they said they're going to change their name too. And so I don't think they'll be able to get theirs changed as quickly, because they're getting ready to start the season in Major League Baseball, hopefully. But yeah, so it looks like you'll have the Redskins changing their name, the Cleveland Indians changing their name. And then really, you know, we've had NASCAR come back, and then now we've had a little bit of golf, obviously, and then we had Major League Soccer started last night, and Orlando and Inter Milan played, and there were multiple, as you said, Damian, gestures made in support and solidarity of the movement that's currently going on across America. There was an 8-minute and 46-second moment of silence, which is how long the police officer in Minneapolis had his knee on George Floyd's neck. There was, you know, kneeling during the national anthem. It was moments of silence. There was, you know, open discussion in postgame about all of the things that have been going on, the discussions that have been happening amongst players and teams. And so it was a very, you know, outward show of support of the movement that's going on in the game that happened last night between Orlando and Miami.
Yeah, Orlando coming out on top, winning 1-0 over it's David Beckham's Inter Miami, isn't it? Shep, just wondering, we've seen that MLS bubble, but what about the NBA bubble? 25 players testing positive in the Disney World Resort. Will we get to see some NBA?
Guys, look, I mean, I am hoping. I mean, I would love to be able to watch, watch sports while I work from home still during the day. But, I mean, it just seems no matter where we go right now, whether it is at the high school level when teams are starting to get back just to do workouts, coaches are starting to get sick, or at the college level, Clemson, LSU, Kansas State, Ohio State, UCLA, I mean, all these places all over the country, you start getting more than a couple of people together in a room, and they spend a little bit of time together, and then a couple of days later, boom, you have double digits that test positive. And then we're starting to see that as well now, Major League Baseball and the NBA, as the players and teams start to make their way towards Orlando, or to their respective cities in Major League Baseball, people are, you know, they're starting to get sick. Two of the teams in the MLS are not participating because they had so many players test positive, the Dallas team and the Nashville team. They're not participating. So, It's going to be really hard to do with this bubble idea that they have. I mean, I hope it works, but as soon as you let somebody go out of the bubble, whether it's a food worker or somebody related to the team, and you let them come back in, you've just reintroduced an entire different set of circumstances. And so it's going to be really, really difficult to manage.
Yeah, as always, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. We'll catch up next week. We're back after this break with some rugby. Southampton are 1-0 up against Everton. And we'll join you shortly.
Game on 2FM.
And you're welcome back to Game On here on 2FM. So, Dunica, Danny Ings with the goal there for Southampton, 1-0 up, and they also missed a penalty. So, mixed evening so far for them.
You're all over it, Damien. You're all over it.
I'm here watching on carefully. So still scoreless between Bournemouth and Spurs, and we've got Aston Villa and Manchester United to come in the quarter past eight kickoff. So Manchester United looking to maintain that good run that they've had. A couple of other stories of news that might have escaped people if they were on the move earlier this afternoon. Alan Reynolds, who was confirmed as Dundalk assistant manager in the most recent past, joining up with the Irish under-21. So good to see that. In the night, I suppose John Sheridan confirmed as the new Waterford FC manager last night, so his predecessor hasn't been out of work for long and is certainly going to be a busy man.
Yeah, Marie had that spot on. We had Alan on last week and she put those two roles to him, and to be fair, he gave the classic sporting answer, sat on the fence and didn't really answer him. There was news today about Lizzie Kelly. She's taking some time away and going to retire from horse riding for a while as her and her husband are expecting their first child. She was the first woman in Britain to win the Grade 1 race over jumps with T42 and Quaid O'Star in the Novice Chase in Kempton in 2005. We wish her all the best.
Yeah, and one of the big partnerships in competitive race cycling has come to an end. Seven-time Grand Tour winner Chris Froome, it's been confirmed that he's to leave Team Ineos, which is Team Sky in old money. He's joining the Israeli Startup Nation. So it brings an end to what has been a very, very long running, and certainly in terms of races won and titles earned, successful partnerships. He's going to team up with Dan Martin. There's a sense around this that Froome couldn't be guaranteed he'd be the top dog where he was, and he's obviously decided to move on now somewhere else where he is guaranteed to be number one when it comes to the Tour de France and everything else. So you'd wonder, where's that going to leave Dan Martin and other teammates along the way?
Yeah, and there was also news that Tiger Woods has announced that he will compete next week's Memorial Tournament in Dublin, Ohio. 15 times major champion is looking to tug out for the first time in 5 months. So it's good to see Tiger back out there, Damien.
It is, Annie. And still, irrespective of what you think of him and all that he's done and all that he's been through over the years, you can be damn sure television numbers will increase next week when Tiger's in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, there's a massive massive games in Super Rugby this weekend, starting with the clash of the Melbourne Rebels versus the Queensland Reds tomorrow just after 10 o'clock. Saturday, Damien, could be pay-per-view with the reigning champions, the Canterbury Crusaders, taking on the unbeaten Auckland Blues, followed by the New South Wales Waratahs and the Force. And Sunday, we'll see the Hurricanes taking on the Highlanders. Johnny Holland and Brent Pope join us now. Two men with completely different fashion sense, but a keen eye for what to look out for in a great weekend of sport. Lads, how are you?
I don't know whether to take that as a compliment or something derogatory.
Brent, we'll get into the rugby, but I think it's a good time to start here with a bit of an intervention for young Johnny about his dress sense. He really does need to reinvent his wardrobe. Can you help him?
I can help him. I'll send him a bit of cover so that he looks a bit better. What's his style like? Is it kind of retro? Is it
younger than Dunners, isn't it? That's what it is.
It's the same as every young fella. Skinny jeans, you know, grey top and a pair of all. What are the Converse? Johnny, how are you getting on?
Good. Good. And silly young fella, unlike yourself, I suppose. It's just a bitter old man growing old too soon, isn't it?
Guys, there's been brilliant rugby, and I suppose it was all helped last week with the Australian sides coming back into it. And Johnny, you wrote a great article on the RT website that explains the rules really well. You might take us through some of these new, the 50 and the 22 kicking rules.
Yeah, I suppose like that's the one that I was most excited by, because with my background as a 10, the kicking rules, the laws are literally a game within a game is what I was kind of saying. And it's I remember when Rob Penny came to Munster, it kind of changed how we like definitely how I looked at the corners, because you had so much organisation around you that you knew where people were in place and you had a better chance to have a kind of a look up into the corner. So I remember playing games, and especially like Ronan O'Mahony, he'd be telling you left corner and you know it, where everyone kind of is, so you can just park that. And if you see that it's on, you can kind of give it a crack. So like that's what I was watching last weekend, especially in the Australian games. And you saw a couple of attempts at it, but I don't think it's coming too naturally straight away. But like I can imagine either the laws around the 22 and clearing the touch when they came in. So the interesting one was, and I was talking to Murray Kinsley during the week, and it was around like when you get a midfield scrum in your own half, you obviously have the defence has to be split and the 15 has to pick a side. Wingers, if they go on a half, the attack will run with the ball. And that's probably what we're trying to encourage, is that attack has a bit more space to run with the ball. And if they don't, because the defenders are playing up high, then you can kick the ball into the opposition 22, bounce out and get the ball back in a line out. So if you're in your own half, if the ruck starts in your own half and you kick the ball, bounce once or more into the 22 and into touch, you'll get the feed into the line out, which is quite encouraging. And the other one, I suppose we saw one example of it in the game at the weekend where the ball was kicked in behind into the 22. I think it was the Reds game, and it was Bryce Hagerty with the Reds. Picked it up, the opposition never kind of checked their backfield, and he just launched one long and got a lucky bounce from his own 22 past the halfway line into the opposition half, and they got to put into the line out. I think it was the last 10 minutes. It could have been a massive turning point. I think Matthew was the hooker, overdrew it, like, so they went on to win the game, but it was it could have been a massive turning point for like a big kick like that. So with kickers and with multiple kickers on the pitch, it's going to be very hard. You know, you'll see like these kind of wiper style kicks when the 10 shifts it a couple of channels in his own 22, and a 13 or a 15 can launch a long kick on the other side of the pitch. It's going to be very hard for these kind of one and two man backfields, as the way the fences are going out, to cover every area of the pitch. So it's a very interesting area that's coming in. We still don't know what laws are going to be playing under, especially in the AL, but I don't know what's coming into the Pro 14. So we'll see what way it's going. But at the moment, watching both competitions in the Southern Hemisphere, you have to kind of nearly do your homework before you watch the game to see what's in play.
Brent, you'd be a purist, but I think we'd all agree, defensive lines now, when we're seeing 14 players, there was just no space. These rules hopefully will allow us to have more, you know, to encourage a running game.
Yeah, that's what they've been put in place for, because the game of rugby union over the years has come to resemble rugby league far more often, in the sense, apart from the line-outs and the scrum, obviously, but defensively. And it's no coincidence we see most of the defensive coaches around the world have a rugby league background. I mean, even Ireland's own coach has a rugby league background. So something had to be done. I don't know whether this is the way forward or not, because it's going to go back to the old kind of rules whereby, you know, they put the ball into the corner all the time and then you have a go at the line-outs. Well, that was in my time when you didn't lift in the line-out and you weren't sure to get your own ball. That's the way you played it. You played into the corners of the field and then you went after an opposition line-out. This way that you'll be able to put the ball into the corners and actually get your own line-out ball. So I take what Johnny is saying, that is what will happen. They'll have to leave the back three back to cover that. But also, will we go back to the days then it's going to be an out half that kicks the ball, the leather off the ball all the time, looking for that line out in the 22? You know, so I don't see yet where it's going to go. You know, they've got to experiment with it before. But you're right about having to be a professional player now and go to trainings and have to learn all the new rules that are coming out. The one I do like is the dropout. If the ball is held up over the line now, it becomes a dropout, because I think that'll take away a repeated number of 5-metre scrums. You know, you get in the last 10 minutes of a game and a team is camped on another team's line and the scrum after scrum after scrum is reset or whatever. So that takes that out of it, which I agree with. I've just yet to see the other 22 or the 50-22 or the 22-50. I'll see how that pans out.
Brent, I actually have nightmares over that one you're speaking about. Just as a front five forward trying to get back behind the ball there and seeing someone try to run it out is nervous stuff. But Johnny's mentioned it there, like for a 10 like himself, and in his column he mentioned Ronan O'Gara being devastating maybe with this new rules. But are we going to see back rows evolving now? Could we see like number 8 spotting spaces? We've already seen it with the New Zealand franchises. Could we see more back rows kicking the ball?
Well,
again, in my day, and probably slightly in your day, if you ever went to kick the ball, you'd be kicked out of the rugby club. You know, I remember kicking a rugby ball in an All Black trial or something, and I felt that would count against me, because I think Alex Wiley was the coach who came up and said, none of my forwards ever kick a ball, Pope, or something. But, look, you know, something has to be done with the game. You know, we've got to look at the ruck laws. We've got to look at the defensive laws to create more space, because, as you're saying, you know, it became over the last few years, a team was sometimes better without the ball than with it. And that should never be the way. It should be a game of running rugby and about space and that. So that's what they're trying to bring in. So, you know, some of the laws have been working in the New Zealand game. I mean, we've certainly been treated to a lot of running rugby. So, you know, it's working. But, I mean, it's just getting a balance between taking away too much of the old game and bringing in the new and retaining some of that game. But I just wouldn't want to go back. You're right. I would like to see back rows becoming more involved in the game now and having different skill sets. But, you know, I don't think one of them is going to be tactically kicking the ball off every scrum for the 22 into the corner. But I can envisage those old days of an out half that's a good kicker sitting back in the pocket saying, right, I'm going to aim downtown for the corners, especially on a windy day, and we're going to plug that and get the line out down in 22. Because in some ways, if you look at it a different way, it actually favours the defensive team territorially, because you can be in your own half, you can be on a windy day, you can be, say, 10 metres in your own half, and then you can thread a ball into the corner 5 metres out and you can get the line out as well. So other teams will say, hold on a minute, why are you giving the defensive side territorially all the advantage here? So I'm not convinced with it yet, I'd have to say, but we'll see how it plays out.
Johnny, I know we mentioned it before and I played with you long enough. There is nothing better than passing your 10 when he puts you into space. But like, from a front five point of view, we've seen in these early games, especially with the New Zealand, we've seen a raft of penalties. It's starting to quieten down. But are we losing the scrum in terms of, instead of free kicks or scrums, they're just straight penalties now, and we're ending up with 30 penalties a game?
Yeah, there was a lot of penalties, and I actually thought that I can't remember which referee did one of the New Zealand games at the weekend. I thought he just overlooked a couple of things because there was a lot of penalties, and like the way it was last season, you know, you could look at every ruck and find a penalty if you wanted to, and it felt like in the first week, the first two games, that they definitely did that and looked for every penalty they could give. And I just felt like last weekend the referee got a little bit softer on a couple of things, but I do think like there are penalties where, you know, these ones in the side where the attacker has overrun the ruck after not getting an offload and he just drives the guy through the side. You know, you're looking at knee injuries and things like that. So, like, I know they're trying to make the ruck a safer place. And with those poach opportunities, you see that they're rewarding the poacher very, very quickly when he gets his hands on the ball. It's a 1 second you can see as a proper poach as opposed to kind of harvesting past the ball. And they're going to give that. But I think they're as quick to give a penalty when a guy is kind of putting his elbows on the ground and kind of scooping back, which I like to see because it's very disruptive, obviously, being like a more attacking-minded player. It's disruptive from an attacking point of view when teams can go in and kind of scrape around the back of the ruck and kind of disrupt the ball, if nothing else, you know. So some of them I think are warranted, but yeah, we have seen a lot of penalties, and it felt like the game was played in the middle of the pitch in the first round of Super Rugby in New Zealand, because it was just penalty and swap over, penalty the other way, and there definitely was a bit of too much whistleblowing going on. But I think they are finding the balance, and I think it's just going to put a bit of manners and maybe safety on the ruck.
Yeah. Brent, when we look at it, the standout fixture of the weekend is the Crusaders versus the Blues. How do you see this going?
Yeah, really interesting one. The Blues have struggled over the years. You know, they always were a great side, you know, one of the best provincial sides in the world, you know, years ago. But they've had scant reward, considering the biggest playing base. But under Leon McDonald, of course, himself an ex-Crusader, Cantabrian, they've really pulled up their socks this year. They've got some exciting young players. You know, they dip into the Polynesian talent a lot more readily than, say, the Crusaders do, because they're coming from a different sort of population base. But they've really been performing this year. In fact, it's Warren Gatland's side, the Chiefs, that have been the big disappointment. But I think the Crusaders at home, it'd be hard to go past them. Look, they're just such a clinical outfit. I thought the Highlanders might have tipped them over last week because, you know, they were missing a few players, but they just do the simple things well, and they come up with these players like Will Jordan or whatever. Like, you know, when I visited Ronan
a couple of years ago when he had those all those players in the academy, the Sebu Reese, the Will Jordans, all these guys. It was an exciting time for him because I said to him, I said, who are these players that are going to make it? And he more or less looked around and said to me, well, look, five or six of them could make it, and they have. Ian Orr, all these guys, Sebu Reese, Save Jordan, all these guys have come through the system and are now All Blacks are close to it. But they're just very clinical. They have a good mix of young talent. They have a good mix, a cracking back line that just doesn't seem to make mistakes. Auckland, more off the cuff, a more of a Polynesian style of game whereby they can break teams open with individual flair. But I just think the Crusaders in Christchurch in front of a bubba crowd. The interesting thing will Dan Carter feature at all? There's been nothing said about that this week, so I presume he's not going to be included. But, you know, to go and play against the Crusaders is like turning your back on Munster and going and playing the season after against Munster. So, it'll be a fascinating match, and I think that the team that comes out will lead the Canterbury. Of course, we've got a couple of bonus points Auckland have, so Auckland really need to win to stay on top, but I think it'll be more about, I suppose, the old adage, who wants it more, and I think it'll just be the Crusaders.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. Brent and Johnny, thanks so much for joining us. You can read Johnny's article on the RT website, which I'd encourage anyone that's interested in the new rules to pick up. Lads, thanks so much for joining us.
We are at half time in the 6 o'clock kickoffs in the English Premier League. So Everton have equalised against Southampton. Richarlison on target after 43 minutes. Danny Ings had given Southampton the lead in the 31st minute. Eventful for Southampton. They've had a goal ruled off through outside. They've offside. They missed a penalty as well. It's still scoreless between Bournemouth and Spurs. That game in the final minutes. That's just gone half time there as well. And they're into second half stoppage time in the game between Leeds and Stoke in the Championship, and Leeds are well and truly home and hose and have been for quite some time. They lead Stoke by 4-0. So last night on the programme, if you were with us, you'd have heard the Republic of Ireland manager Stephen Kenny chat at great length to our soccer correspondent Tony O'Donoghue about all sorts of things. And in the course of it, the issue around scouting and the difficulty of getting out and about and seeing players and seeing what squad makeup you might have came up, and it got us thinking about the challenges of scouting during a global pandemic. And we decided who better to chat to than Lisa Fallon, the manager of the London City Lionesses, who's also, of course, worked for Cork City, has been an opposition analyst for Northern Ireland and has worked as well with the Dublin GAA team. Lisa, how are you?
I'm really good, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad. It's good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us. It's a whole new world. Gareth Southgate has talked quite openly about the challenges of not being able to access Premier League grounds and everything else. One would imagine it's eminently possible to scout to the same level you would want to, but it's a time maybe for embracing technology a bit more than usual.
Yeah, I think, look, to be fair, there's really good technology in professional football that, you know, I think Stephen mentioned Y-Scout and the systems like Instat as well. And these are systems, online scouting systems, that basically have almost every game, every professional game in the world on them. And you can go online and you can watch games, you can watch players. And these systems have been around for a long time. And, you know, at times like this, they're really, really useful. And particularly like at Cork City, when we had European games, when we were playing in the Europa League, you know, sometimes we'd be playing on a Friday in the league and then you'd be playing the team from Europe on the following Thursday. So really, and you might only know, you know, 10 days before who you're playing against if you were lucky, and you had very little time to scout them. So those types of systems were really good to give you, I suppose, an indication and an opportunity to watch the team. The only thing is, and I often say it, is that when you watch a game on TV or in that type of, you know, on video footage, unless it's from a really high level where you can see the whole pitch, it's a little bit like watching a game with an eye patch on, because you can see where the ball is, but there's a whole lot going on the pitch that you can't really see. So whilst they definitely are very useful and they can give you a good indication, it, you know, nothing actually beats being able to go to a game and physically actually watch the team live and in the flesh. You see so much more.
Yeah, Lisa, you mentioned it there, and two of the softwares you're using, is it Wyscout and iStats? Maybe, could you explain to us, because like we all saw John Egan's performance last night, and straight away you get analysis from the TV that he made two tackles, he made two clearances, intercepted two balls, won 70% of his duels. What additional information are you getting?
Well, I think when you're at the game, you can see where the players are in relation to the other players and in relation to the opposition, and there's a whole lot more that you can see. You can see what's going on off the ball, because quite often what's going on off the ball has a big impact on what's going to happen next in a game. So to be able to see that when on TV footage, quite often the camera comes in quite close. So you can really see the close-up, say, for example, like the goal. You can see the replays and the little movements and the ducking and diving that might go on in the box too, and, you know, and how he breaks the line of the defender to make the contact and stuff. But that's really good for in close contact. But in general play, obviously, the more of the pitch that you can actually see, the better.
And Lisa, I suppose the challenge in a situation like this for most elite teams, or certainly teams that have high ambitions about how they're going to go about their work, is the bulk of the work what you will learn from potential opponents from the games that they've gone and played in already, rather than trying to look at specific games about how maybe a certain playmaker or a dominant player will interact with his teammates throughout a match?
You look at it in different ways, because obviously teams play in different ways against different types of opposition, and obviously different managers have certain ways of playing as well. So you take all that into account, and it's really about having as big a knowledge base as you possibly can about a particular team and the players that they have available, and then to try and use that information to predict what they might do against you. It's, like I said, the more you can see, and that's the beauty of international football, is that you get so much time between your games to really go in at a much deeper level than sometimes you might be able to get from, you know, when you're, say, for example, if you're playing a European game and you've got quite a quick turnaround, but you can still go into quite a good level of detail. But certainly, you know, there's all sorts of things that you take into consideration in terms of how you predict what the opposition might do against you.
Lisa, it's fascinating when you're outside the sport and you see some stats that don't really matter when you're in it. And for you as a manager now, we used to have things like we'd mark how long you stayed on the ground. So you were out of the game, you were no good to your team, you were caught, and it was lying on ground, L-O-G, you were a log and a waste of time. What are you flagging that, you know, might be of interest that we don't know even about on the outside sports world?
Do you know what? The one thing I have learned is that every manager has their own thing. So you, on those kind of generic systems and on TV, we see lots of really generic stats about team possessions, where possessions are, the number of passes completed and stuff like that. But the one thing I have learned is that each manager generally will have their own way of playing, and that you monitor your way of playing. So you quite often at that level would produce your own data and your own information, which is relative to your specific way of playing or the way you're trying to play in a specific game. So it really, every manager has their own different things, and really you can't go into it with very preconceived ideas, because a lot of it comes down to the players that you have and the players that are available to you for a specific game, and that largely dictates what you can and can't do, or can, what you can aspire to do or aim to do.
Lisa, before we let you go, obviously I'd imagine at this stage you're well into planning for the start of the Women's Championship season. It's what are we, about 4 or 5 weeks away, or maybe a little bit more than that at this stage? So I presume it's COVID-19 testing and those structures, as well as it is player recruitment and getting a sense of how you want your new team to play.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really busy. We actually had our first COVID-19 test today. So hopefully all will be well and we get our results in 24 hours. And then that sets us up to come back into training next week. So we have phased return to training. So it's like one-to-ones, and then we move into small groups, and then we move into team training. And please God, all being well, we'll be able to get back on the pitch and playing competitively in and around the week. The first weekend in September, I think, is the aspirational date at the moment. So all being well, everything goes to plan across for all the clubs across the league, and hopefully we all get back early in September.
Brilliant. Lisa, wish you well with the season ahead. Thanks for being with us as always.
Thank you.
Lisa
Take
Fallon
care, lads.
Joining
Cheers.
Us there. Dunica, we've navigated the hour. Everton, Southampton 1-1 at halftime. Bournemouth, Spurs still scoreless. Leeds 5-0 winners in the end, and Villa against United still to come at a quarter.